Ruben and his team from RB Technologies on Route 14 in East Montpelier has been creating and supporting thoughtfully designed, custom-crafted computer networks for their clients since 1997. Here's Marsha Curtis from Capital Steel.
He's our IT specialist. We go to him for everything that we need for the computer systems, our security systems, our perception monitoring. If we've got a question about our email, a computer, Windows, any kind of situation that we run into, we run to Ruben. Oh, his customer service is great, along with being extremely professional. They're very personable. It's not like somebody sitting in here and talking a bunch of computer speak to you. They actually listen. They answer your questions in English, which is really good. And they don't look at you like you're absolutely crazy. You know, when you say, my computer is making this really strange picture or whatever it's doing. And they always seem to come up with a solution. It's really great. It works really well for us.
RB Technologies cares about their customers. Online at rbtechvt.com. RB Technologies, efficiency through technology.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Thank you, Jim Connie. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. And we all made it to a Friday. That's, I guess, success right there. Coming up on the program in just a moment here, we're going to talk with environmental activist Bill McKibben. Big event last weekend in New York City. That the People's Climate March, quite successful, and Mr. McKibben, one of the lead organizers on that. We'll take your phone calls throughout the program as well. Love to hear from you at 244-1777. That's our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. Of course, we will funnel every discussion towards number two, retiring Derek Jeter. Again, feel free to join us throughout the program at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Coming up Monday on the program, we'll talk with gubernatorial candidate Dan Feliciano. And then later next week, and actually on Tuesday next week, we're going to talk about the cell phone ban. I know you're all ready and organized for that. Joining us live on the line this morning, let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to the organizer of 350.org, the author of End of Nature, and Middlebury resident, or Ripton resident, Bill McKibben. Thanks for joining us, Bill. How are you this morning?
Hey, Mark, I'm good, and it's good as always to be with you.
So last Sunday, big rally in New York City. What did it accomplish?
I don't know. I mean,
okay.
One never knows right off the bat. The point of big marches is not kind of subtle political intervention. You know, it's not like giving a huge campaign contribution to a senator so he'll vote your way. I mean, those sort of things are easy to measure. In this case, the goal was to change the zeitgeist some, to make people think about climate change in a different way, to show it's not a niche issue. That there's a lot of political weight behind it. And so the fact that we had not just by a factor of four the largest climate change rally ever, but one of, if not the largest political gatherings about any subject in many years in this country, was a good sign, I think. And I have a sense it's going to resonate now in a lot of ways. I think it'll help continue to build the movement. Everybody there, I think, including a couple of thousand Vermonters, and I am so grateful to everyone who took the trouble to get down there on a long, weary bus ride. I think everybody there had a great, powerful time and came away feeling part of something large and powerful. And that's good news. I mean, you remember how all this began, really the climate movement in this kind of marching phase anyway began in 2006 when we walked up the west side of Vermont for 5 days until we got to Burlington. And at that time, there were 1,000 people by the time we got to Burlington, and the Free Press the next day called it the largest climate demonstration that had yet taken place in the country. So to grow 400 times as large in 6 years seems to me like a good sign that we're on an ascendant path.
Who was at the rally? Is it changing who's at the rally?
It was incredibly diverse. You know, there's this old stereotype of the environmental movement as just kind of affluent white people who don't have anything else to worry about. But that's, I think, probably never been true. It's certainly at 350.org, though we began in Madison County, we've organized in every country on earth except North Korea. So we knew that this was a big diverse movement, but boy, everybody could see it on Sunday. The march was led by wave after wave. I mean, you know, 15 blocks worth of what we were calling frontline communities, places that had already felt the effects of climate change. And many of those were people of color, and particularly indigenous communities, a huge turnout by Native Americans from around the continent who have felt this at every turn, watched their land taken for projects like the tar sands, watched as the ocean begins to rise against their coastal homes, you know, on and on and on.
Who were you trying to reach, really? I mean, really?
Well, I think we were trying to reach the whole country. To see, you know, that's sort of the point, to break out beyond the people who already know. And I think that was pretty successful. The news coverage was fantastic. You know, not just in the sort of normal places. Someone was describing to me, having seen The View the next day, and all the panelists there, just going on and on about, you know, what a great thing the march was and how crazy it was that our government didn't take climate change seriously. Because it's a no-brainer. Unless you're an oil company, the fact that for 25 years scientists have been giving us increasingly strident warnings, and that for 25 years our government has done next to nothing, is a serious indictment of how well our government works.
And what's your theory on why collectively governments or the world can't address this?
I think that there's a couple of reasons. Change always comes hard for economies and institutions, but by far the biggest obstacle here is simply the power of the fossil fuel industry. This is the biggest, richest industry on Earth, and perhaps you will forgive my cynicism if I say that in our system and many others, having huge sums of money allows you to exercise somewhat more influence than the power of your arguments would otherwise give you.
Mm-hmm. This whole effort to divest of fossil fuels seems to be gaining some traction.
It sure does.
Where's it at?
Well, it was really a great moment, Mark. Sunday night after the march, we were up at Cathedral of St. John, with a bunch of religious leaders from around the world, you know, really amazing religiously. Sue and I were standing there in the at this gathering, and the head of the Rockefeller Brothers fund stood up and said that the Rockefeller family had decided to divest all its money from fossil fuel. And you should have heard the cheer that went up from all these rabbis and bishops and whatever else there all were there. People were truly excited, as they should be. I mean, here's the heirs to the largest fossil fuel fortune on Earth saying, we think it's now immoral to be invested in fossil fuel. They also said, we think it's unwise if, from a business point of view. And I said, if John Dee himself were alive today, he'd recognize that the actual business opportunities were in clean tech, and that there was a dangerous bubble around fossil fuel that's going to take down a lot of investors with it. So I think that was a pretty signal moment. I mean, there have been a lot now of universities and church denominations this summer. The World Council of Churches, representing 580 million Christians, divested. But I think the moment when the greatest oil fortune there ever was decides it wants nothing to do with oil is a pretty signal moment, and we have high hopes that others, including Vermont Governor Shumlin, will follow quickly.
Do you think it'll be the tipping point or not?
Oh, I don't think there's ever just one tipping point, but I think it gives us enormous power to keep on fighting. It's definitely wind in our sails.
We're talking with environmental activist Bill McKibben. You can join us at 244-1777 is our local number, toll-free 877-291-8255. Speaking of Governor Shumlin, he was on a program here with David Goodman on WDEV a week or so back, talking about divesting in fossil fuels, and really has changed his tune.
Apparently, and it's very good to hear. So many props to David Goodman for his strong reporting there on getting the governor to more or less commit now.
Calling it a good idea.
Yeah, and saying it may take a little while. It's fine if it takes a little while to do it. We've actually told people, institutions, to take 5 years to actually sell off their stock so they don't have to do it in a kind of fire sale kind of way and sell at the bottom of the market. What we need are the announcements now. So I hope that sometime in the next little while, he and Treasurer Pierce make clear that Vermont will be doing this, just as Vermont did around apartheid a generation ago. We actually need some, we need him to do what he says and not to back away from it.
Well, there's some, including the Treasurer, Beth Pierce, who make the argument, the same argument you heard during South Africa in divestment, that it's better to engage, you can...
Yes, and this was the argument that really the Rockefellers engaged best, I thought. One of the things they told the New York Times was that member after member of the Rockefeller family had meetings with the Exxon, that's the descendant of Standard Oil, SO, Exxon, over the years to try and urge them to do something, and they'd had entirely no luck. It seems to me that if the family that founded the company is and was huge shareholders, it isn't going to have any luck in persuading Exxon. My guess is that Beth Pierce, with a couple of other things on her agenda, probably isn't going to have much luck either. So I think the talk about engagement is mostly just cover for not wanting to do anything.
Let's go to Hyde Park. Mac, good morning. You're on the air with Bill McKibben.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks.
Good to speak with you, Bill. Hey, I'm a Republican, but I'm very interested in protecting the environment. And the thing that alarms me about the idea of, getting off of fossil fuels is that it could lead to more expensive power prices and less availability of power, and that would damage our economy. And so I would be very keen to see more nuclear power, and that would alleviate that fear. And I don't think that I'm alone in worrying about inadequate power. Power costs have been a problem in Vermont, and I'm scared that if we could easily find ourselves with even more expensive power and not enough power.
Well, I think you're not. I think you're probably not doing the math particularly well. I think it's sort of old school. In the first place, of course, every economic analysis shows that dealing with climate change is good economics, that the cost of runaway climate change is so much higher than anything else that it'll wreck our economies along with everything else. But the question then becomes what to do about it, and I suppose nuclear power is an option, although I would say you're going to need a better organizer than me if you want to build a new nuclear power plant in Vermont. I don't think it's happening. I don't think it needs to. I think the place to look, probably, if you're interested in conservative economic approaches, is Germany, ruled by the Conservative Party for the last 10 or 15 years, and the place that's embraced renewable energy more than any on earth. I saw today that Munich, the conservative capital of Germany, will be 100% running off renewable power by 2025. And I think you'd have to agree that the Germans have an economy that almost anyone would envy. That's the reason that they're doing that, is precisely because they've looked at the economics. The cost of nuclear power plants continues to rise and rise and rise. It's been a steady upward curve. The cost of renewable energy, on the other hand, plummets downward as we get better at it. The cost of a solar panel has fallen about 99% in the last 40 years. solar and wind are already at grid parity, you know, the same as other generation in many states and many countries around the world. And it's only the sort of incumbent power of fossil fuel that keeps it in the game. It's able to wield its political power to make sure that it fights off renewable energy, at least in our political system. Thank heaven not in Germany, where they're demonstrating what can be done.
James Lovelock, the environmentalist, the guy who wrote The End of Gaia, talks about nuclear power being a bridge technology to the next whatever comes along that really will power everything. I mean, as you know, I mean, nuclear power is also base load power, so that, you know, one of the problems people point out about renewables is it's not consistent.
Yeah.
So is nuclear power, I mean, do you go along with Lovelock, or are you...
No, I don't. I mean, look, if you were going to build a bridge, you'd have to do it right this second. How long, Mark, you've looked at American politics for a while, how long does it strike you it's going to take to build a big generation of nuclear power plants in this country?
Probably not in my lifetime.
Yeah, well, there's the answer. And so we need things we can build in our lifetime.
But do you look at it as a technology that's sound, that it does, it's carbon, it's less of an impact, carbon?
I'm glad that people are continuing to investigate the kind of new generations of it. Jim Hansen at NASA, who, as you know, I much admire, thinks that there'll be some kind of fifth generation nuclear power of maybe powered by thorium or something and small and whatever. But none of that's remotely near to being done. What is being done right now, and you can drive down Route 7 any day and see it, is solar power. What we know how to do, and you can drive, you know, in much of Vermont and see it today, is wind turbines. And these things work, and they work affordably, and they work cleanly. That's what we can and should be doing.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. So as an organizer, Bill, what do you do? How do you take the energy of last Sunday and move it forward?
Well, the good news is, of course, that I don't have to do most of it. people on all those endless bus rides back home were figuring out all kinds of next steps. And you know, my influence in all of this is highly overrated. You know, people like 350 Vermont are, you know, already at work on a big agenda of their things, and they don't need me to tell them what to do. But I think in the larger sense, we take that momentum and put it to work in all the campaigns that are underway. We play defense a lot against bad projects, and projects like, you know, from the Keystone Pipeline to the proposed coal ports on the West Coast to fracking along the Appalachians to, you know, we have 350. You'll like this, and I think it's going to be beautiful and powerful. We have on 12 Pacific Island nations that'll be underwater soon. Our 350 Pacific team, traditional, indigenous people on those islands building traditional canoes this summer. They launched them last week, even as we were in the streets of New York, and by mid-October, they'll be blockading with those canoes the largest coal port in Australia, the largest coal exporter in the world. So all around the world, we're playing that kind of defense. But we're also on offense with things like this divestment campaign, which is the fastest-growing such anti-corporate campaign in history, according to a study from Oxford University. We're on offense trying to figure out how to, in many places, get a price put on carbon that would allow us to measure the and price into markets the damage it does in the atmosphere. There's an awful lot going on, and it's beautiful to see. I guess the real meaning of last Sunday's march for me was that a game is fully engaged. I can't promise you we're going to win. The fossil fuel industry is incredibly powerful. They've bought off large parts of our political system in this country and in other countries. But on our side, we have a growing movement, which brings different currencies than money. It brings passion and spirit and creativity. And sadly, we have on our alongside Mother Nature, who continues to demonstrate with each passing week the folly of doing what we're doing. I mean, look what's going on in California, even as we sit here talking. They're in the depth of the deepest drought they've ever measured, the hottest years ever recorded there. Now there's forest fires burning in every part of the state. This is the richest part of the richest country on earth, and yet they're coming apart at the seams. The message is starting to get through.
Let's go to Barry. Mike, good morning.
Yeah, I got a question, Bill. I think that's a great thing that you're doing, and I'm glad you're all getting together over this. But I have a real, I'm wondering, how much fossil fuel do you guys use traveling all over to these events? I mean, you've got 300,000 people or more.
No, that's the real
problem. That's quite a bit of fuel that you're using.
That's pretty much it.
Are you using biodiesel? And I'll listen off the air.
I think that's pretty much why the planet's heating up, is that there are just too many people taking part in global warming protests. Very powerful point. Actually, if you think about it, a pretty not-so-powerful point. We live in the world we live in. If we were going to try and organize to change it without using any of the tools of the world we live in, then we'd lose. There's nothing the fossil fuel industry would like more than us not to turn on the computer, not to assemble in crowds to take them on, simply to retreat into the backwoods and stay quiet about it. I think that's the kind of I think that's the kind of charge that even a child can see through.
Okay, but I read your last book, the Oil and Honey book.
Yes.
And you talk about sitting at the top of the runway, going to these conferences and feeling a twinge of guilt.
Absolutely. What I said about this march in Washington, when many conservative commentators tried to raise this same charge of hypocrisy, was this is the best gallon of gasoline that anyone will ever burn, the most useful. We'll be coming here to join this protest. And I don't think that people need to feel guilty about it in any way. Just the opposite. Should feel extremely proud for engaging in activism. The point really is that this is not a problem solved by individual changes. Yes, everyone should change their light bulb. I assume everybody with the conscience has. I've changed mine twice. Sue and I went from incandescence to compact fluorescence and now to LEDs, and it's good. The light is good and we like it, but we don't try to fool ourselves as we do it that that's how we're solving global warming. This is a structural and systemic problem, and it'll be solved, if it's solved at all, by structural and systemic changes. That means politics. That means coming together as Americans always have when they want change.
Let's go to Richmond. Richard, good morning.
Hey, good morning. No one ever talks about the other part of the carbon equation. Now, I remember back from high school chemistry and physics, it said, you know, the oxygen level in the country, in the world, was 21%, and the rest, you know, 85% helium and some other odds and ends. As we keep burning to add more carbon into the air, what's happening to the oxygen level? Is it going down? Is it being displaced? Is it being... I guess I worry about that more than I worry about carbon dioxide now.
Well, that case, you don't need to worry about it too much. The changes in oxygen levels for the foreseeable future are so small that they'll have no effect. Carbon dioxide is a trace gas. It's in very small quantity in the atmosphere. Like any, you know, like many trace things, it does its damage even in very small doses. I mean, you don't need much arsenic to have a big effect. Your blood is still mostly what it was before, but the arsenic in there did its thing, as with CO2. So right now, we're at about 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. Not that much, but it's more than half again as much as we had during the Holocene, the period of when human civilizations grew up, the period that lasted until sometime in the last 20 or 30 years. And that more than half again as much has been enough to cause, well, melting of summer sea ice in the Arctic. The oceans are about 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago. You know, we're seeing remarkable shifts to extreme weather every place, documented not just by the world scientific community, but by the world's insurance companies. So it didn't take much. No need to worry about oxygen. We'll all be able to breathe for a while. Worry about the effects of that extra heat trapped by the molecular structure of CO2 in the atmosphere that otherwise would have escaped back out to space.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for your call. 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. So, Bill, one of the other things that people that are skeptical about climate change are raising is this whole idea that the temperature rise is actually slowing from what the UN report said it was going to a couple of years back. Can you talk about that?
Sure. That people say, oh, it's paused, the rise in temperature. In fact, the last decade's been by far the warmest on record. And if you measure not the atmosphere but the whole system, mostly the oceans, you find that, in fact, it looks like, if anything, global warming has accelerated faster than we thought it would. The ocean heat content is rising very, very fast, and this will eventually, as everyone concedes, work its way back out to the atmosphere. What's worse, Mark, is that even with relatively small changes in temperature, it's only about a degree Celsius at 1.8 or so, 1.6 or so globally so far. We're seeing way bigger changes in results than we thought we would. I mean, when I wrote The End of Nature, which came out 25 years ago this month, we would not have thought that 1% rise in temperature, a 1 degree rise in temperature, would be enough to melt the summer Arctic. But if you think about it in other units, you begin to understand just how much heat we're adding. The estimate is that because of the extra carbon in the atmosphere, we add the heat equivalent of about 400,000 Hiroshima explosions daily that wouldn't be there otherwise. And that's been enough, you know, to melt that millennia-old ice across huge swaths of the north. It's been enough to drive amazing feats of evaporation. The estimate for California alone from this current drought, last month the scientists said that California had lost 63 trillion gallons of groundwater to evaporation, and that the weight that came off the crust of the earth was enough to allow the Sierra Nevada to jump half an inch skyward last year. The changes we're making are monumental, in fact, geological, in fact, biblical in scale.
Were the Rockefellers pressured?
No, I think they decided they wanted to do the right thing. I mean, they've been trying to, in their philanthropic giving, work on environmental things for many years, and I think they just finally realized what a contradiction it was, just as it's a complete contradiction for Vermont to worry about climate change as it did in the wake of Irene and continue to invest in the companies that are gaming the political system to make sure it continues. I mean, say you hold money in Chevron. That means you were party to giving the biggest single campaign contribution, corporate campaign contribution in human history. 2 weeks before the last federal election, designed to make sure that the House stayed in the hands of climate deniers. It was successful, and if you own Chevron, then you're a part of it. We're past the point, given the scale of this problem, where it makes sense to try and play both sides against the middle.
With the South African divestment, there, you know, the attempt was to kind of starve the government of money. So with this oil company and the fossil fuels, at the end of this, you hope the oil companies go out of business or do
not really.
What? Or do what?
And in South Africa, it wasn't really either. No one thought that, you know, General Electric was actually going to be starved of money. We can't
bank. No, I meant the government.
Yeah, but I mean, the effect was to go after the companies that supported the government. The point is not to bankrupt them. Exxon's too big in the short run to bankrupt. The point is to politically bankrupt them to the degree that we can have institutions that have wide respect, churches, state governments, colleges, universities, withdraw their support, announce that they're breaking with these companies, their ability to dominate our political system begins to weaken. That's the hope. It's no guarantee, but, you know, it's the one other time it's really been tried on a large scale, South Africa. It was crucial. When Nelson Mandela got out of prison, prison. The first trip he took was to the U.S., and the first place he went was to California, and he talked to students and faculty and alumni at the UC system, one of 155 colleges that had divested, and he said, we liberated ourselves, but we could not have done it without the pressure that came from y'all. And in a globalized world with a globalized problem like climate change, even more so.
Now, somebody sent me a story about Germany that claims that they're still burning a lot of coal. They burn something called lignite.
Lignite's just another name for coal. And Germany's coal use has gone steadily down. It went down 4% in the first 6 months of this year. Germans produce about less than half as much carbon per capita as Americans, and they're moving quickly in the right direction. The Germans think, Munich said it would be 100% renewable energy by 2025. The Germans think that their country as a whole will be about 70%, I think, renewable by then. In fact, there were days this summer when the Germans generated 75% of the power they used from solar panels within their borders. So compare that to the about 1% of American power that comes from the sun at the moment, and you understand what room we have to change, especially since, we happen to possess Florida, Texas, California, Nevada, New Mexico, Arizona. It's not Germany's great surplus of sunlight that's giving it this edge. No one ever took a beach vacation, to Stuttgart. It's their political will. And happily, political will is a resource that we can summon up. In fact, that's what we were trying to summon up last Sunday in New York.
Last area I wanted to ask you about is the Keystone Pipeline, which again has been delayed. So is delay good in this?
Well, it's good in that each day it doesn't happen. There's another 900,000 barrels of oil that don't get through. And it's good in that it makes it riskier and more uncertain for investors. So yesterday, the huge Norwegian oil company, Statoil, announced that because of pipeline delays, it was canceling a big project it was planning to build in the tar sands, a project that would have added over its lifetime the carbon emissions of 164 million cars. So those people, those Vermonters who went down to Washington to join in that big civil disobedience the day after Irene hit Vermont, those Vermonters should be proud to know that they played a big role, an outsized role. They used real leverage. Now, do I wish Obama would not just delay the thing but kill it altogether? I do. I wish it for many reasons, including that it would be nice to have a politician once in a while who just acted decisively instead of shilly-shallying around.
Last question. I got an email here from Jim who asks or says, equating CO2 to arsenic is silly in any context because without CO2 we all die. Also, Rockefeller is the epitome of rich white folks. The question is, can traditional Vermont as we know it, live it and work it, exist in Bill's future without carbon fuels, and if so, how?
Well, as I say, clearly can. Germany is at the same latitude that we are, and if we put the same kind of will to it, we'll be okay. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy, but compared with not doing it and then trying to deal with the consequences of global warming, it's going to be easy indeed. If Jim or anybody else wants to be told that this will be no problem and that they won't have to work at it and we won't have to make changes and things, then I can't tell them that. We will. But Vermonters traditionally have been pretty good at making change, at dealing with new reality. We've often led the world in doing that. We already have more solar jobs per capita than any state in the Union. It's already a big and growing part of our economy. If Jim's idea of the future just is to keep sending big chunks of our money off to Saudi Arabia every year, then so be it. But I'd much rather, I'd much rather see the Green Mountain State able to power itself, and in the process, employ its neighbors and get the job done.
forgive the shallowness of this question, but I think it's also an important question. Do you think that in any way the tide is turning here? Because when you and I have talked in the past about this, Bill, you've been pretty pessimistic.
I'm more optimistic than I've been. I don't know how the fight's going to come out. We've waited a very long time to get started, and we're pretty far in the hole. It's not a good sign when your big physical features on the planet, like the Arctic or the oceans, begin to break. But I'm really clear now that there is going to be a serious fight, that this movement is growing strong and beautiful. And we saw that Sunday. I guess what I think is it's very clear we're at the beginning of the end of the fossil fuel age. The question is whether we can kill off the fossil fuel age quickly enough to save the climate or not. And I don't know the answer, but I do know that it depends on how hard we work to bring about that change. We can't have more delay. We can't have governors saying, oh, we'll go and study this for a while or something. We need people to act. If we can make that action happen, then we've got at least an outside chance.
At last count, how many institutions, organizations are following this divestment plan?
It's a good question. Hundreds and hundreds of big institutions, the most recent this summer, the ones that really cheered me up were not just the World Council of Churches, not just the Unitarians, not just the United Church of Christ, but I was very pleased when following in the footsteps of Stanford University on the West Coast, the University of Dayton, which is the biggest research university in that radical hotbed, Ohio, divested. It's a Roman Catholic institution, and their leader said this is simply not compatible with our moral teaching to be invested anymore in these guys. I think that's a good sign, and in fact, we're expecting an encyclical from Pope Francis sometime in the next few months on the environment, and hopefully that'll add to the momentum as well.
What about Middlebury?
We'll hope it happens. We'll hope it follows Sterling College and Green Mountain College and others in Vermont who are setting the pace.
You think they're going to revisit it or not?
I think everyone will be revisited all eventually. It took 8 years, 9 years for most colleges to wrap their heads around divesting from apartheid, and I imagine that this will happen more quickly simply because Mother Nature keeps pushing the action.
Thanks for your time this morning. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Take care, brother.
Bill McKibben is the author of The End of Nature. His most recent book is Oil and Honey. That's a nice read. It talks about his neighbor who's a beekeeper. Also, he was one of the lead organizers of the People's Climate Change, which happened last Sunday in New York City. We'll take your phone calls at 244-1777. That's our local number in Central Vermont. You can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. We'll be back right after this.
Hi, Todd Stone from G-Stone.